Let's begin with Revelation 20. Let's begin in verse number 7. And when the 1,000 years are expired, Satan shall be loosed out of his prison, and he shall go out to deceive the nations, which are in the four quarters of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle, and the number of whom is as the sand of the sea. And they went up, this army that was coming to battle, they went up on the breadth of the earth and compassed the camp of the saints about and the beloved city, we know that to be Jerusalem, and fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. And the devil that deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and the false prophet are, and shall be tormented day and night forever. And I saw a great white throne, and him that sat on it, from whose face the earth and the heaven fled away, and there was found no place for them. And I saw the dead, small and great, stand before God, and the books were opened. We saw those books on your left-hand side of the auditorium this morning. The books were opened, and another book was opened, which is the book of life. We saw that on the right side of the auditorium podium. And the dead were judged out of those things which were written in the books according to their works. And the sea gave up the dead which were in it, and death and hell delivered up the dead which were in them, and they were judged every man according to their works. And death and hell were cast into the lake of fire. This is the second death. And whosoever was not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire. There were a couple things I thought this morning that were so helpful to me, being reminded that in a perfect utopia, there will still be a desiring of sin in this perfect millennial state. Number two, I was so helped because I know many people struggle with the idea of the works. Who's judged for their works? And I thought this morning it was very clear. The unsaved are judged for their works, their sins. The saved are judged differently. I want to look at that in just a minute. And then I thought it was very helpful the way that the message finished off. I really liked the way there was hope at the end. And so many times when you preach a message on the great white throne judgment, you get to the end, and I love the thought that there is hope for every one of us. So that's where we were this morning. A couple questions that came to my mind, and I would like us to ponder them tonight. Number one, how does the devil rally such a rebellion? Now, you know, look in verse number 8. We know that he gets a big group together because the last phrase in verse number 8, it says, of whom, or the number of whom is as the sand of the sea. Now, this is a hyperbole. We would say maybe it's a simile with like or as, but it's hyperbole. John would be saying, there were so many of them gathered together, they were like the sands of the sea. Can't count them. Now, this is a phrase that's used often throughout the Bible, and it always is describing a group that just cannot be numbered. So the question is, how does the devil, in a perfect utopia where Christ is ruling with a rod of iron, where we are deputed under him as regents to rule the earth, we are incapable of sin ourselves. We've already received our new glorified spirit body over in the rapture. So Christ will never sin. He is not capable of sin. We are now no longer capable of sin because we're like Christ. We are the ones ruling. There is no outside sin. There's no outside injustice. Nothing evil. And yet, when the devil is loosed from his prison for a short season, he quickly gathers a host of people together to fight against Christ. And there's so many of them, it's like the sands of the sea. A couple things that I want us to think through. Number one, to deceive. To deceive is to cause to roam, to cause to go astray, to cause to err, or to cause to wonder, or to seduce. So the devil is now loosed, And he has but a short time, and he is able in a very brief moment with all of his fury and all of his anger, which shows you can incarcerate somebody for 1,000 years and still not change their nature. The devil's nature is not changed any more than man's nature is changed by being in a perfect environment for 1,000 years. So the devil gets out, he quickly gets a group together, and they lead a rebellion against God. Now, what does the devil use to deceive the nations? What does he say? What would the devil say to someone to cause them to join with him to fight God? Knowing that 1,000 years earlier, when God showed up at the Battle of Armageddon, there were really just two actions. The beast and the false prophet were thrown into the lake of fire, and Christ spoke the armies dead. So how does Satan get a group to join with him to fight the same guy again? The only thing I can think of is this. The hearts of men are so angry, so sinful, so proud, so full of vice, that when the devil is loosed, men will say, we would rather think he has a shot to throw down Christ this time. And they join with him. I don't really understand how, but I'm struck with the power of deception. By the way, you'll note, just in this chapter alone, notice what it says about the devil in verse number 3, middle of the verse, that he should deceive the nations no more. Verse number 8, and he shall go out to deceive the nations. Verse number 10, and the devil that deceived them. So the devil will cause people to err, to go astray, to roam, to wander, and to go with him. And then it kind of brought me to where I am today. How does the devil deceive us today? Now let me ask you this. How does the devil deceive us when it comes to sin? Let's chat for a minute. We all agree the devil's a deceiver. In chapter 12, it says the devil that deceived the world, deceived the peoples. So how does the devil deceive us, Christians, about sin? And he does. How does he do it with us? Eugene. Oh, that's classic. Well, this sin is like, this is a code C sin. It's like an orange code. It's not a red. This is just one of those okay ones, right? Does he do that with you, or am I the only one? Yeah, okay. We know it. It's deception. How does he deceive us about sin? Justified. Rationalize it. Yeah. Well, you know, really, if they wouldn't have done that to you, you wouldn't have had to, you know? Yeah, I see a lawyer over there shaking her head. Yeah, that's exactly what you do. You deal with people who do this all the time. You justify it. Rationalize it. Hey, is it, you know, really, in that circumstance, really what you did, it was just expected, right? What other options did you have? It's rationalized. How does he fool us about sin? Oh, you won't get caught. Yeah. As soon as you said that, I went back to Moses. He looked this way and that. And when he saw that no man was around, how does the devil deceive us about our priorities? Now, this is getting closer to a good Christian sin. How does the devil deceive us about our priorities? Yeah, yeah, and you're actually getting into number 3. And so I'm going to reserve that one and call that one back in just a moment. Yeah, good. Somebody. Sam. Good for your family, good for you. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, and you know, really, I know God's important and all, but really, what about your family? Right? He fools us all the time with our priorities. Let me ask you this. You know somebody who doesn't have their devotions every day. Now, I know they're not in your home, but you have a ministry with them. They're on your Facebook account. You know what I mean? Why do people not have time in their daily schedule for devotions? It's their priorities, but what does the devil say? How does he deceive us about that? You are so busy. I mean, really, who's got a schedule like this? You got three kids in the house. You got to do laundry, clean up, do laundry, clean up, clean up, clean up. Look at the last one. How does the devil deceive us about doing spiritual things? And I would like to call back Susan. How does the devil deceive us about doing spiritual things? Yeah. Okay, so to every choir member, to every deacon, to every usher, if you're not very careful, the devil will deceive you into getting so busy about what you're doing that you forget what you're here for. I saw an email, you know the little tagline that people put at the bottom of their emails? I saw one this afternoon, and it said, "Keep the sun always in your eyes." You know, after driving all week, I'm thinking, really? And then I saw the way the sun was spelled. Keep the sun always in your eyes. Pretty good thought, huh? Okay, the devil's the master deceiver, and he will deceive the world. Question number two. How large is the Gog and the Magog rebellion? How large is it? In verses 7 through 10, it says that it reaches from the four quarters of the earth. So I thought the world was a circumference. Why does it speak as if it's a plane? And I think this is hyperbole. The north, the south, the east, and the west, the four quarters, the four corners of the earth. But notice this next phrase, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to the battle. Verse 9, and they went up on the breadth of the earth. Breadth of the earth is an interesting word, and it means the broad plains. Now remember, the breadth of the earth is talking about all these plains. Well, what happened to the topography during the tribulation? All of it was changed. Do you remember in the very last, in the fifth of the vials that were poured out, all of the mountains went away. It appears that there is one mountain for sure, Mount Zion, where Jerusalem will be, where Christ will be, but it's almost as if, and Pastor Mike, you're welcome to chime into this in just a minute, but it's almost as if there's only like one mountain on the whole place, but a lot of broad plains, and this army that will come to Jerusalem to fight will encompass the plains. So it's massive. There's so many, it's like the sand of the sea. Okay, number three. We see the words Gog and Magog, and if you've long been around the Bible, you're going, Gog and Magog, I have heard that before. Gog and Magog was used back in Ezekiel 38 and 39. And I will say this. Now, number three, Pastor Mike, and I may not even exactly be all right, but I'm not saying I'm right. I'm just going to say this is an idea. Gog and Magog are talked about in Ezekiel 38 and 39. And now it's mentioned over here in Revelation chapter 20. So the question that comes into my mind is, oh, is this the Gog and Magog that's spoken about in Ezekiel 38 and 39? And I'm going to say, in my opinion. Did you see that? I did not say in the Bible. I said in my unpublished, unasked for opinion, I don't think this is the battle of Gog and Magog from Ezekiel 38 and 39. I'm just going to give you two reasons, and you can shoot them down in just a minute if you want to, Pastor Mike. But these are two reasons that it just comes off in my mind. Number one, the Gog and Magog described in Ezekiel 38 and 39 are before, chronologically, before the millennial kingdom, which is talked about in Ezekiel 40 through 48. So as you're reading through Ezekiel, you come into Gog and Magog, and then you have the millennium. So it seems like this battle that's being talked about happens before the millennium. Well, now over here, the millennium has just happened, and now they've got Gog and Magog. So I don't think it's that. And one other reason, in Ezekiel 39, verse number 17, and I just put this in your notes for those of you that want to go home and check it out and send me an email about it. I think when I'm reading Ezekiel 39, 17, 38 and 39, but about verse 17, it says they came over and God defeats them in the mountains. Well, when we're in Revelation chapter 20, verse number 8, it says that the Gog and Magog are gathered in the broad plains. Doesn't say anything about a mountain. So I don't think that Gog and Magog is the same. So you would then ask, okay, what's Gog and Magog? Gog is a name. It seems to be the name of the leader, the human leader who is leading this revolt on Christ. I read this and I'm thinking, I wonder if the same way that that Satan empowered an Antichrist, I wonder if there is another Gog figure that he will help a human leader. And Magog seems to be his kingdom. Now, I will say, just for interesting things, Magog, as you begin to see Magog, we see this back after the Tower of Babel, and it seems that it's the descendants who settled up above the Caspian Sea, which is where a lot of modern-day Russia is. So I don't think this Gog and Magog is the one talked about in Ezekiel 38 and 39. I think this is just a name for a rebellion that's going to come against Christ at the very end. Number four, is it really a battle? Do you see in verse number 8? They're in the four quarters of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle. To battle. And then when I read in verse 9 and 10, I just wonder, is it really a battle? Look what it says. They, Magog, this army, Gog and Magog, they went up on the breadth or the broad plains of the earth, and they compassed the city. They walk all around Jerusalem. They have Christ pinned in. And all the saints are there. And by the way, if you were a saint and you were living on the earth, you would want to be in close proximity to Christ. Doesn't that just make sense? Especially when you see the armies coming on. We're going to go back to the champion. We're going to get under him. I think there's a great dynamic parallel for the way we live our life. I hope we live close to Christ. Verse number 9, it says, "And fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. And the devil that deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone." So is it a battle? It appears to end as quickly as the battle of Armageddon. Is it a battle? I think that's the word John used. I remember one time we had this goofy kid in our class. He was the funniest kid in our whole school. He was slight, skinny. He was one of the guys who could cut you down in 3 seconds, and it was just so funny because the way he said it, you know that guy? Skinny, frail, not a sports guy, just really a brain. He's probably writing satire for New Yorker probably today. I don't know. I remember one time he looked at we had a big lineman on our team. His name was Lee Cook. We called him the Cookie Monster. I just thought I'd use a football illustration to bring you back home. We called him the Cookie Monster. He was, for a Christian school, he was about 240, which was really big for Christian schools. Not that we didn't grow our boys big. We just didn't have a lot of boys, you know? So it was a lineman. And I remember Gene Gooden said to Lee Cook, and Lee was mouthing off, and kind of Gene was mouthing off to Lee, and Lee was getting a little bit upset about him, and Lee said, "I'm going to knock you into next week," and Gene Gooden looked at him and said, "If we got in a fight," I'm doing my best Southern drawl here, Denise, I know you'd appreciate that, with sweet tea in my hand, "If we got in a fight," Gene said, "there'd be two hits. I'd hit you, and you'd hit the ground." You know, it's kind of like, really? Which is what made it so funny. Do we call this a battle? Is it really a battle when they get up around and then, whoosh, fire comes down? Now, let me go back for our Old Testament history. Has God ever sent fire as a means of judgment? If so, when? Yeah, yes, that's right. You get two choices, yes or no. Tell me one, Jay. Yeah, Nadab and Abihu, fire came down. Good. Where else? Sodom and Gomorrah, yeah, Genesis 19. Any others? How about when the guys came up to Elijah, the group of 50? Hey, preacher man, come on down here. You know, it's extra crispy. It's medium well. So I don't know that it's really a battle. Number five, how will the great white throne judgment be different than the judgment seat of Christ? And I'm going to throw this out, and you may have questions, and we can come back to it, and I gave you some notes here. But this morning, Pastor Mike, as he was preaching, had his books up here, and he talked about they were judged. And in fact, in verse number 12 and verse number 13, it says they were judged according to their what? Works. So these people at the great white throne judgment are judged according to their sins. for the profane, for those that have taken planes and ran them into buildings and caused the death of thousands. It just seems like there is a difference in that judgment. Okay, is there a difference? Yes. Yes, the judgment seat of Christ is for believers. So no sins will be judged. Now think through that for just a moment. Is that right? Are you meaning to tell me that because I'm a Christian, I'm going to stand before the judgment seat of Christ and I will not have to be judged for my sins? True or false? True. When did my sins get judged? On the cross. Great white throne judgment. Have they accepted this salvation? Mm-mm. So somebody's still got to pay for their sins. So there is a massive judgment, massive difference in the judgment. The judgment seat of Christ is for believers, no sins to be judged, only our works for Christ. It's a rewards evaluation. The great white throne is for non-believers, and they will be judged for their sins and according to their sins. All right, so here's number 6, and this is Jason's question. Do you have an answer yet? Okay, I looked at his notes. Pastor Mike, it was just one of those precious things. I don't know. I think the exact words on his paper were, if God knows what Satan is like, why would he let him out? Isn't that a great question? So God's got him penned up. He's there for 1,000 years. Remember the angel that comes down? He's got him in one hand. He takes the chain, he wraps around it with the other hand. He throws him in. He seals it. He locks it. So why in the world would God let him out? Great question. You tell me. Why did God let Satan back out? Sam, start it off. Tell me what that means. Not about Satan, it's about me. Keep coloring. That's huge. It's huge. All right? Let me tell you what I think Sam's saying here. We have all these people down on the earth. Outward conformity to the max. When Christ says, no profanity. Guess what? None. No pornography on television. None. These people growing up still have to choose Christ. Now remember, we talked about this last week, it was reiterated this morning. The people that go into this millennium are only Christians, only the sheep, those who have been declared righteous, Matthew 25. Only these people get in, but they have children, right? Which was so precious this morning when one of the children of this church, who every single person in this church would have said, that boy's a Christian. That boy's a Christian. When the preacher down at camp said, hey, you have anybody in your church that's not saved? I said, well, I don't know, but I do think that the best looking kid in our youth group might not be saved. That's the way it's going to be in the millennium. Outward conformity to the max. If Christ wants short hair above the ears, tapered off the neck, short hair above the ears, tapered off the neck. If he wants their socks to match, they match their socks. Inside, they are absolutely furious with God. So why does God, Jason, let the devil out? He lets him out so that those who were outwardly compliant but inwardly rebellious can make their own choice. I say this to all of our young people tonight. You may be outwardly compliant, but if your heart is inwardly rebellious, God knows it. And Satan will find you. He will. He will. And your anger, resentment toward your parents, your anger about life, your frustration with why this didn't come the way you thought it should, Satan will come along, he'll snap his fingers, he will look at you, say some kind of false line, and you will leap to your false Savior. So that's why God let the devil out. Just a piece. Do you see the notes there? I just put a statement in there. It almost sounds blasphemous. God has chosen to limit His sovereignty in the area of the free will of man for man to choose Him. Does God know everything? Yes. Is He all-powerful? Yeah. All-omniscient? Yes. Can He do anything? Yes. Is His grace greater than any force in this world? Yes. But He has chosen to limit Himself. How about Agrippa? Almost thou persuadest me to be a Christian. How about this verse? Whosoever shall call upon the name of the Lord shall be saved. So God's chosen to limit His almighty sovereign power in one area, and that appears to be the free will of man to choose Him. So that's why God lets Satan out. All right, number seven. Seven is your questions. I want to finish up with number eight, but I thought I'd take a couple questions up front. You do have two people on the panel today, and so if I don't know the answer, there's a good chance somebody else might, or we can phone a friend. All right? Questions. We've been through a couple weeks of Revelation. I don't know that we had a question and answer time last week. Any questions you've had? Alyssa, if you do this, I'm going to call on you. Yes, sir. Yeah, I do. And I meant to put that on here tonight, and I just forgot. Okay, so I'm going to quote a couple verses. You quote a couple verses. Pastor Mike made a statement today, there are degrees in hell. I absolutely believe Christ taught that. I believe we are saying nothing other than what Christ said. And here's what He said. He walked into a town of Bethsaida, and He had done 11 of His 33 miracles in this town. One out of every three miracles He's done in this Capernaum area, and He's done them in here. And these people have rejected Him, and they still look at Him and say, hey, do you got a sign for us? And Christ said, woe unto you. It is better for Sodom and Gomorrah in the day of judgment than it'll be for you. Sodom and Gomorrah, they have a portion of hell that'll be hot, but these people that have rejected Christ repeatedly, it's better for Sodom and Gomorrah than it's going to be for Chorazin, Bethsaida. Any other verses that you want to chime in on that? That's the main one I was thinking. I want to say it's in Luke. It's probably in a couple of the synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. But that's the area. That's the verse. Okay? Yes, sir. Correct. Is that a statement or a question? Okay. Let me tell you how I... Yeah, that's your statement. And I think your statement fits. And so I didn't know if you were asking something else. Brother Collazo said this, in heaven there are degrees of reward and degrees of crowns. Absolutely. Christ has clearly taught that. Those who are faithful in little, faithful in... they will be faithful in much. And the rewards in heaven are based upon our degrees of service. And by the way, it just makes sense that the equal and polar opposite would be the exact same way. So there would be degrees in hell for those. Okay, I often have people saying, I know you want to jump on that one or something else? Okay, save your thought. People will say, what about the people in New Guinea who have never heard God put enough truth into their hearts so that they are without excuse? We came out of the box with a default that said, I believe in God. In Ecclesiastes chapter 3, God says, He put an eon or an eternity in our hearts. That's where we worship. We worship in this eternal hole that's inside of our hearts where you can never fill it up. You can't fill it up with money. You can't fill it up with happiness. You can't fill it up with a great marriage. You can't fill it up with great kids. You can't fill it up with being on a sports team. You can never fill up this hole because it's a God-sized hole that can only be filled by Him. And God built us that way so that even those people are without excuse. Jay.
After the Where are these people being judged and where are they being
fired? Yeah. Okay, I'm going to tell you right now, way above my pay grade. I don't think the Bible says. I do know that we do know that the earth and the heavens will flee away. We see that in Revelation chapter 20, about verse number 10. And we also see it in 2 Peter 3, where God says that the earth will be consumed with fire. The question to me is not necessarily how is God going to do it without an earth, but I wonder where in the world God is going to do it. I don't think we have to be, we won't be land bound. And these people will already be people that have died, and so they will be spirits resurrecting with their bodies. So we will have a totally different constitution. Philippians chapter 3. And our vile body will be fashioned like unto His glorious body, and therefore those that have come to this great white throne judgment will also have a spirit body that will be connected with their soul. And so it won't be limited by the confines of matter like we are now. Do you want to jump into that? Okay, good. Any other questions? Yes, ma'am. Great question. Are all the saints going to be in Jerusalem, or will they be spread around throughout the earth? I think they'll be spread around throughout the earth. They will be, because the rebels will come from the four corners of the earth. And so however the earth looks after the tribulation, it will be very vast, and it will be, the population will explode. Because this morning, Pastor White was saying, reminding us that the people will, there will be a child at 100 years old. There won't be a need for mortuaries. There won't be a need for graveyard. Sorry, Chad, it's over. I hope you don't need a new employment, but it's just a totally different world. It won't be the death phase like we see now. People will be spread out. The saints will be all spread out. I was more tongue-in-cheek saying if I were a saint who was living and I saw all of these masses coming, I would run to Christ. And that was more what I was meaning to say. I hope it didn't confuse. All right, one more before I ask the last one. Going once? Going twice? All right. Look at number 8. Verse number 15, chapter 20. Whosoever was not found written in the book of life was cast. Whosoever was not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire. How should a message on this passage impact our lives? Now listen, right now I'm asking for everyone to do more than just hear. I'm saying every one of us needs to apply. This is an application question. We heard this morning about an awful, horrendous judgment where everyone is guilty who stands at this judgment. How is this going to affect us? Or the question should be, how should this affect our lives? What do you see? Both you guys said the exact same things. We should be out there telling people, talking to people. Both you guys said the same things. I agree, it should impact our lives that way. Hey, by the way, can I ask this question? You've said it. Get mad at Miss Burlock. Get mad at Brother Harold. How many people will you tell this week? Vicky and Harold just said, if we really believe this, we'd tell people. So don't get mad at Pastor Mike and I. Will you really tell people this week? Do you believe that? Is this message going to impact your life? Or not? Anybody else? How else does this impact our lives? What's some practical things? Serve God more? Yeah? Yeah, make sure I'm at the right judgment. Absolutely. Absolutely. And by the way, that's what causes a lot of people to come back and say, wait a minute, now, am I sure? That's what Pastor Mike asked us today. Is your name in the book. Right? Good. How about let's just put some things on the bottom shelf. I have a couple of things I'm thinking, my thinking is so much lower right now than yours. Just bottom shelf. If we really believe the message, what would we do about it this week? How would it impact our lives? Jordan? Yeah, I really think if I believe that, I wouldn't toot my horn at the guy in the left lane when he should be in the right lane, you know. It's got to impact me some way. Yeah. Oh, that's huge. Will you get up tomorrow morning and confess to God, I am a rebel at heart still. Oh, I need the grace of Christ to wash me again. I need those new mercies. Will you get up that way to approach God, or will you get up this way? Okay, where am I today? 1 Chronicles 29, further reminder of David, son of the king. All right, that was a good chapter. That's interesting. Yeah. Did you guys get to hear that in the back? He said it should cause us to well up with gratitude. Absolutely. I believe we saw that gratitude modeled this morning. I don't know where you were sitting. I was sitting right down the front. Pastor Mike was preaching. I really believed he's glad his name's in the book. I just believe that. I believe he was worshiping this morning as he was preaching, right? I believe that gratitude should be in our lives. Anybody else want to close it off for us? Chad?
Never underestimate the power of Satan to deceive. Make sure we have our priorities straight. Right?
Yeah.
He's probably telling us priorities are wrong.
Yeah, boy, and that's an interesting one. Never underestimate the power of Satan to deceive. Three times in one chapter is he called the great deceiver. He's going to deceive the whole world. So it's obvious he's good at it. Drive us to our knees in prayer. Yeah, I agree with that. Christ, I need you. Anybody else? Oh, yeah, who we pray for and why? Yeah. We were praying, maybe in the deacon's room, or in our room with the deacons beforehand. I don't remember. Maybe it was in Sunday school this morning. It was for Tim's dad, who has cancer, or they're trying to determine what kind of cancer he has. And as we were praying, I was just struck with something this morning. Lord, allow Tim's dad to represent you well in the big crisis he's got, so that maybe unsaved doctor will say, wow, there is something so different. Yeah, so it affects who we pray for and how we pray.